I think that was, whether intended to be so or not, a tremendous advertisement for why community radio is so important, because aside from your show and some community radio stations around the country, there was a little bit of mention of this, to their credit, on MSNBC, where the only commercial media that's ever picked it up until quite recently. But basically, these are the sorts of stories that affect the most disaffected in our society, the most depressed, that slip through the cracks of corporate news media, of NPR, who basically see the world from what it looks like when you're on top of the mountain looking down, not when you're at the bottom looking up.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast of the February 4th, 2016 edition of Tell Somebody. Tell Somebody podcasts are produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the show's broadcast on KKFI. This show was a live pledge drive broadcast with Professor Robert McChesney on the phone talking about the value of community radio and the need to support it, and about the new book he co-authored with John Nichols, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. This was the last pledge drive show I did on Tell Somebody before ending the weekly schedule the following month. You'll hear the phone numbers repeated often. The pledge drive ended that week, but you can support KKFI anytime, day or night, at www.kkfi.org. I do plan to produce an occasional show when I can, so do keep an eye on the blog pages, www.tellsomebody.us and www.tellsomebody.libsyn.com. Like the Facebook page, facebook.com/tellsomebodynow, and follow me on Twitter @ Tell Somebody Now. Would love to get an email from you. The address is mail@tellsomebody.us. So, let's go right now to the recording of the broadcast with Bob McChesney from February 4, 2016. Hello, and welcome to Tell Somebody. This is your host, Tom Clammer, 888-931-0901, 888-931-0901. Please support your community radio station. This could be the last pledge drive edition of Tell Somebody, but whatever happens to Tell Somebody, it's important that you support the idea of this kind of public affairs. And this morning, to help me out in asking you for your support, Professor Robert McChesney has returned to the show. Robert McChesney is the Gutzel Endowed Professor of Communications at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, author of many books, and including co-author with John Nichols of the recent book Dollarocracy, and of the forthcoming book People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. Bob McChesney, are you with us?
I am indeed. It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
Well, we really appreciate your taking the time again, and I hope you don't mind if I want to get to your book and other things, but I'd like to get your reaction to about a two-minute clip about a Tell Somebody show 2.5 years ago almost about the Flint crisis. Mike, can we roll that one?
What is this emergency manager empowered to do?
The emergency manager takes over all control. So he or she assumes all of the power and authority of the elected officials. And even more power than that, really, the power to, at their sole discretion, enact local law by decree. So they can just say what they, you know, what they would like to be law, and it happens. There's no democratic process. They can also disregard existing local laws that are in municipal charters or ordinances that are contained there. And one of the more important facts for workers, especially if you're looking at the Detroit bankruptcy, is that the emergency manager can dissolve all union contracts. They can sell assets. What you saw in Pontiac when an emergency manager was named in Pontiac was that they sold the Pontiac Silver Dome. They're not accountable to anyone but the governor, and as his political appointees, they do the bidding of Governor Snyder.
Totally confused as to why something that drastic hasn't gotten more prominent play in the media, but
65%, I believe it was, of all African Americans in the state of Michigan at one point in the state were actually under the control of an emergency manager. So wow. They're elected officials for a vast majority of minorities in the state had actually been removed from their democratically elected positions, and there was an emergency manager who was overseeing all of the actions of their communities. There was some discussion about selling the Detroit Water Systems, which supplies water and sanitation for a number of communities outside of the city limits. And to privatize those services. That also happened in Pontiac. They did end up privatizing their water service. And the emergency financial manager is able to make that decision on their own arbitrarily. They don't answer to the voters. They're appointed by the state, and there's no one really who can remove them from that position except for the governor. People need to realize, not just here in Michigan, but all across the country, that if we allow this the extremism to take hold in other places. And Detroit is a perfect example of what can happen when extremists are able to kind of craft their own policies and do what they want. And, no one is immune, Tom. I think that what people need to realize is that it's Detroit today and your community tomorrow.
And, Bob, I hope you'll forgive me for bringing you on and then subjecting you to that, but I did want to get your reaction to that. That was nearly years ago.
I'm glad you played that for me, Tom, because that was I think that was, whether intended to be so or not, a tremendous advertisement for why community radio is so important, because aside from your show and some community radio stations around the country, there was a little bit of mention of this to their credit on MSNBC, where the only commercial media that's ever picked it up until quite recently. But basically, these are the sorts of stories that affect the most disaffected in our society, the most depressed, that slip through the cracks of corporate news media, of NPR, who basically see the world from what it looks like when you're on top of the mountain looking down, not when you're at the bottom looking up.
Yeah, and as you said, MSNBC, notably Rachel Maddow, covered this emergency manager business quite well, but by and large it was totally ignored. But does it make a difference if some little community radio station covers it? Why should listeners support that kind of coverage? Does it matter?
It makes all the difference in the world. Most of the really important stories start on the fringes, and then finally, through popular pressure, move into the mainstream, much like this Flint story. It started on the fringes, and it wasn't just Rachel Maddow came up with this out of blue. Probably her producers heard about it on a community station, and that's where they saw about it. And then they became aware of it and followed it up. And then the New York Times has gotten it now. And now it's an issue in the Democratic presidential race. The Republicans probably are just cheering it on, if anything, not to be too facetious. But I think it points to the exact role that even a small media, a community station like KKFI or a station anywhere across the country, can play a really crucial role. And it's a great crown treasure for all of us to have these sort of stations. We've got one in Madison. We have one in Champaign, Urbana, the places I spend most of my time. And they're just they're absolutely resources that are indispensable to everyday life. And so I urge people call, make your pledge, make your donation. I know a lot of people are tapped out there because you're being a candidate this year. There's a lot of elections. But understand, we need the infrastructure of self-government, of democracy in our communities, or else elections aren't going to ever resolve halfway either. We can't put all our eggs in one basket, so to speak.
Yeah. The number to call, if you agree with Professor McChesney, is 888-931-0901, 888-931-0901. It is important. You can also make a contribution safely and securely on the internet at www.kkfi.org. In the upper right, there's a word donate. Click on that and rock and roll. 888-931-0901. KKFI listeners, especially alternative radio and David Barsamian fans, I think it was just last week, within the last 2 weeks anyway, heard a speech that you gave in, I think, Oregon last fall that, if I'm not mistaken, kind of touches on what's in your new book with John Nichols about to come out. Sounded a little scary. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it's scary, but it's also hopeful if you believe in the adage that the truth will set you free. And I assume anyone who is being media should hopefully believe in that adage. We're in a situation now where unemployment, underemployment, downward pressure on wages and working conditions is at epidemic proportions in the United States. And I think it's not going away. By all accounts, stagnation, growing inequality, growing poverty, a terrible labor market is going to be the order for tens of millions of Americans, especially young Americans, coming into the labor market. It's a starkly different world than the world I experienced in the 1970s when I entered the labor market. And I didn't, 1970s was really a recession when I came into it, but now it looks like an absolute golden age by comparison. And this is going to be the future. Everyone gets this. This is not a debated point. And what we do in the book, John Nichols and I, is we talk about why this is, to some extent, it's built into the nature of capitalism. But we also look at what's going on concurrently right now, which is we're in the midst of a technological revolution with artificial intelligence and computerization that is going to radically transform our lives, but also radically eliminate a lot of traditional job categories. So into a very stagnant, slow-growing economy with high rates of unemployment, underemployment, and declining wages, we're now introducing something that's going to make it far worse. How much worse it's going to make it, how soon it's going to happen, we don't know, but it's not going to help matters at all. And our point is this sets the defining political issue of our coming times, you know, how we address a political economy, a capitalist system that is going to make a lot of money for a few people who own the machines and the robots and the monopolies at the top, increasingly is leaving everyone else out in the cold. Now, as we wrote the book, Tom, what's interesting is, you know, John and I are both close to Bernie Sanders. Bernie wrote the foreword to our last book, Dollarocracy. And, you know, this book, although not intended that way, probably does as good a job as you're going to find explaining why Bernie gets 85% of the support of people under the age of 30, why it automatically go to him, because he's the only one who sort of gets that we need a revolution. People are in a moment now that's not going to get better without fundamental change. And all the traditional establishment politics and media stuff simply is not up to the job that's necessary. And we also talk in the book at great length about the solution to this problem is the rejuvenation of democracy and democratic institutions. And we talk at length about the great history in America of campaigns and programs to establish a more democratic, egalitarian, and just society, which is a much richer tradition than most Americans know, including progressives. You think, hey, we've always been losers on the outside that represented 2% of the population at most, because that's what the people in power want to think. In fact, quite the opposite is the case. We have a rich history in this country going until very recently of spectacular popular movements to extend and enhance democracy. And it was striking to me that when Bernie Sanders, in his speech in November at Georgetown University, when he was asked to address what does he mean by being a democratic socialist, he wisely, and to my pleasant surprise, invoked Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Economic Bill of Rights. And in 1944, President Roosevelt, and we write about this at length in the book, President Roosevelt was looking at the battle against fascism worldwide and said, what can we do to make sure this scourge never returns to the human race? And he said, what we need to do is we have to enhance democracy. We have to make democracy so strong that fascism will never have a chance. And that means we have to empower people who have never been empowered before. He argued in his State of the Union address when he began his third term as president, that we needed a second Bill of Rights, effective like the Bill of Rights we have in the Constitution, guaranteeing people a right to a job, a right to a job at a living wage, a right to belong to a labor union, a right to housing, a right to education, a right to health care, all the fundamental rights of an advanced society. So these must be guaranteed now. And he also said we cannot allow monopolistic power in the economy. We have to have more competitive markets and protect small business and workers from ravenous large monopolistic corporations. So it was an extraordinary statement by President Roosevelt, and it's really pretty much Bernie Sanders' platform. Similarly, and last point I'll make in this, Martin Luther King in the 1960s put together with A. Philip Randolph what was famously called the Freedom Budget, just to redirect the priorities of the United States government. And the Freedom Budget was drawn almost directly, verbatim, from FDR's Second Bill of Rights. And the Freedom Budget is what Bernie Sanders stands for. So the Sanders campaign today, and what our book talks about today, the movement today, grows out of rich American traditions. Our greatest president, the person we have a national holiday named after in King. And Americans need to become familiar with this and embrace this tradition because it's the only way out of the crisis we're entering that doesn't turn us in a very dark direction.
And I just need to jump in here and thank somebody who picked up their phone and dialed 888-931-0901, 888-931-0901. And I want to thank Elizabeth from Kansas City, Missouri, who did that. Thank you very much, Elizabeth. And a rock solid, longtime supporter, Marlon Beach from Kansas City, Missouri. Marlon, thank you very much. Yeah, you said you touched on Bernie Sanders' economic policies, and I just can't help mentioning that, I guess a year or so ago, as minority Senate chair of a economics committee, I forget the exact name, he named Kansas City economics professor as his chief economist, Stephanie Kelton. She's been on Tell Somebody a couple of times and has for years been on the Heartland Labor Forum, a very different view of economics than what you get from the corporate media and the debt obsession and austerity idiocy. Give us a call and support the station that gives you those kinds of voices. And Bob, I try to be optimistic, and I get a little help from you sometimes, but you mentioned Martin Luther King, and I keep thinking about his New York speech in 1967, where he said, "There is such a thing as too late. Over the bleached bones of countless civilizations are written the pathetic words, too late." Are we going fast enough?
Well, it's impossible to predict the future. But I think there's clearly reasons to be concerned. But the space can clearly pick up. If I told you a year ago, Tom, on this show, what would happen in the next year in terms of overwhelming youth support for progressive political change, unprecedented in generations, you'd say, well, that's going to be a good year. I like that. That's a good pace. So we've had that year. We've had an extraordinary year. And you could say, okay, I'm moving the goalpost back another 80 yards. That wasn't good enough. And maybe it'll be proven, maybe it peters out.
But I think the last year has been one of the great years of my lifetime. I've been on the road. I've been talking to young people. This is exciting times, Tom. And your listeners should understand this. We're in a moment now of crisis, of all sorts of problems. We're in a moment, too, now where there's some more clarity because the conventional mainstream establishment politics, establishment economics is so failing, and the corruption is so palpable that there's an opening now for a candid, honest discussion and an embrace of alternative policies that has not been there in a very long time. And I think we should be getting the driver's seat and drive a truck through that hole. I don't think we should be whining that the hole's not big enough.
Well, and just to advocate for the devil just a little bit more, I take what you're saying, and it is pretty amazing, but then I look at how many people don't have the benefit of liberal arts education from community radio, and I also see a corporate media has created a Donald Trump, and the brings to mind the F word and a lot of support there. All the more reason to support community radio, you think?
Of course it is. And I think anyone listening to the show, if you haven't made your contribution today, you're making a big mistake. This is the time to support community radio. This is our lifeline. But my point is that, you know, I think there's been a tendency by a lot of progressives to be comfortable or get accustomed to the notion that they're irrelevant, marginal, and pretty much ignored. And that's just sort of the logical order of things. Hey, open the door, open the window, look outside. It's our time is here. We should seize it. And community radio is right in the middle of that time. You mentioned Donald Trump. And one of the things we write about in the book People Get Ready is that in moments historically, when you have rising unemployment, underemployment, increasing poverty, when the system is mired in corruption and not working, basically a situation like we have in the United States, there are historical precedents for the moment we're in, and you alluded to it. If you go to the 1930s and 1940s, that was exactly the scenario then. You had massive unemployment, stagnation, and corruption across the world, and the center collapsed, the mainstream collapsed as it is now. And there were basically two sides standing. There were the fascists on one side, and there were the democratic socialists on the other side. Even the communists in that period made their gains carrying the banner of democracy. And that's the situation we're in right now. It's going to either be, you know, Trump represents the other side, which is increase the authoritarian state, diminish democracy, just let me have all the power, and I'm just going to go kick ass and wave the flag, and you can trust me, I've got everything under control, and I'll make us great again after I pile up a few thousand or a few hundred thousand bodies and demonize some ethnic groups. That's the extreme fascist position. There are variants of it. And I think it we can use the F word. Historically, that is precisely what that movement is. Now, we also know, both in Germany and Italy and Japan and all kind of Hungary, countries that have had successful fascist movements, Spain, that some, though not all, but some of the people who support fascist governments actually do so with a populist intent. They have, you know, that's why fascist movements invariably have an anti-big guy component to them. They have a populist component. It gets thrown overboard as soon as they get into power, always, but to gin up support. And Bernie Sanders understands that, and he wants to go to battle for basically white working class votes on economic grounds. And no one's made that fight seriously in the United States in 75 years. And I think someone finally is. And I would think listeners to a show on labor should be absolutely tickled.
Yeah. One more time, the number 888-931-0901, 888-931-0901. I've had podcast downloads from over 90 countries. If any of you are listening to the podcast after the fact, you can still go online at kkfi.org and click the donate button anytime. But those of you in Kansas City listening live, pick up the phone, 888-931-0901. Nobody really knows how big the difference to nudge this the Trump way or the good way, you could make the difference. You and other people listening to community stations in Madison, Wisconsin, or Urbana, Illinois, or wherever. But you in Kansas City, give us a call, 888-931-0901. And Bob, reading some short reviews of your book and hearing you on alternative radio, tell us some more about how big a deal is going on in terms of technology. You have at least raised the question, if not concluded yet, that this could be, you know, one of the three or four big changes in human history. And I think you talked about some meeting of corporate leaders in Germany. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I'll tell you briefly three things that'll sort of clarify why we should be what's on the horizon right now. Just last year, not too long ago, CEO of one of the largest industrial corporations in the world, a German company, was having a private dinner for supporters, friends, executives. The sort of dinner with a few hundred people, and with the bottles of wine all cost at least $1,000. So it was like a Hillary Clinton fundraiser. And this was in Germany, and it just so happens that a very close friend of mine, an American who's married to a German who lives there, attended the dinner. And in the question and answer period, they asked the CEO of this corporation what he thought of automation and robots, and if they would really ever be involved. And his answer was that they already have one completely automated factory, and that they have the technology right now to automate all their factories. And he said, the reason we aren't doing it right now is political, because if we were to do so, it would immediately eliminate several hundred thousand high-paying German jobs. And he said the middle class of Germany would burn. And that's the only reason they haven't done it, he said. And Germany is very advanced in this area. But, I mean, I think that's a sign that corporations around the world have access to technology. And I've read all the engineering reports, and this is what they're all saying. And the reason for this is twofold. First of all, there's something called Moore's Law that goes back to the 1960s. And it was developed by a guy named Gordon Moore, who's the co-founder of Intel. And he posited in the 1950s that computer power would double every year and a half. What you get for a dollar, the amount of power would double every year or a year and a half, some say 2 years. And this, you know, if you project that out over 5, 10, 15 years, that means, you know, 2 to the 10th power is a million. So that's a million times increase after 25 years in computer power for the same dollar, much faster, much stronger. And so it's a radical idea. And what happens, though, is if you extend Moore's Law, which has held true from the 1960s to today, what you find is when you double computer power every year, year and a half now, you're getting into dizzying places. I mean, the power of computers, what they can do now, is so far beyond what they could even do 5 or 10 years ago. To give some sense of what I'm talking about, when the new iPhones came out in the fall of 2015, just the iPhone sold that weekend, the first weekend it was available, had more computer power than all the computers in the world in 1995, all of them. And that already looks like ancient history. That was 2 years ago. So we're in a moment where the power of computing is escalating at unbelievable rates. And that means it can do all sorts of things that would have been thought impossible. Driverless cars are the tip of the iceberg. Right now we have the capacity to have fully driverless vehicles for everything. And it's really the kinks, since we're talking mostly political, not technological, it's there. And so that's great in some hands, driverless vehicles, because you know you can have a much more efficient society, much more ecologically conscious. You don't need anywhere near as many cars. You could share vehicles. And they could move without any accidents. I mean, everything would be ideal if you had everything done driverless and no humans out screwing it up. But the downside of that is, you know what the number one job is for men in the American economy, Tom? It's driving cars, vehicles, cars, trucks, buses, cabs. That's the number one job for American men is driving. And those, so if you do a driverless car thing, it might have great ecological benefits. It might be great in the long run. But in the near term, you're basically wiping out the economy. So that something was a problem there. And then finally, what I would add is to give some sense of just how sweeping what's on the horizon. There's a group called DARPA, which is connected to the Pentagon, which is in charge of doing high-tech research. And they're the people who came up with the Internet, basically. And for the last 10 years, they've had a robotics program. And they've been encouraging the development of artificial intelligence and robotics to see where it would go. And the head of it resigned last summer after 10 years, I think, to go into the private sector. And he wrote an article, and I read it, and he said, what's on the horizon now in terms of what we can do with robots, computers, artificial intelligence, is the equivalent of the Cambrian explosion. And unless someone's an anthropologist or a geologist or an anthropologist, they wouldn't know what the Cambrian explosion is. But the Cambrian explosion refers to the period 550 million years ago, before the dinosaurs, when life on Earth went in a relatively sudden period, went from single-cell organisms to complex organisms and intelligent life. And it took place over 20 or 30 million years, but it completely changed life, made possible the dinosaurs, us, everything. So we're past comparing this to like the printing press or writing or the alphabet or even human language. We're now comparing this to the Cambrian explosion, the scientists working on it, in terms of the impact it's going to have on our society. So that's what I'm talking about.
Pretty big deal indeed. This is Tom Clammer. You're listening to Tell Somebody on KKFI in the midst of our pledge drive, 888-931-0901, 888-931-0901. Light up those phones. It is important. Do what Ted Judd did. And I don't know if he's just in town today or if he's listening online, but it says he's from, and forgive me if I mispronounce this, Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Thank you very much, Ted Judd, for giving us a call and supporting this community radio station. And also thanks to Dave Armstrong from Shawnee, Kansas. We really appreciate it, and I hope you'll both tell a couple thousand of just your very closest friends about why you like to listen to this community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, www.kkfi.org. And we're talking to Communications Professor Robert McChesney, co-author of the forthcoming book, People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy, co-written with John Nichols. And Bob, you were just going through a lot of what I think would go in the jobless economy sector. Tell us some more about why citizenless democracy is in your subtitle.
Well, because the whole key to addressing this change in the economy is going to be how we politically address it. And our other argument, and this is not controversial at all, is that our political system now is completely incapable of addressing the changes in our economy and coming up with ways to make creating an economy that works for all of us, because we have a citizenless democracy. And this isn't a controversial point, as I said. I mean, all the political science research by our leading political scientists, pretty much in the last 5 years, all the great studies have come to the exact same conclusion, which is the big money owns the board, and the interests and values and concerns of the vast majority of Americans have absolutely no effect whatsoever on the important decisions that are made by government at any level. So the campaign, so in that context, if we have economic crises, we're going to have a decrepit, pathetic political response, because it will be shaped to the interests of those who own the country. So the crucial thing is, in our view, the way out is to democratize society, have pro-democratic movements, to expand the power and the efficacy of democratic self-governance, and then we can actually come up with solutions. So if these technologies work for us, they solve environmental crises, they enhance the quality of our lives, they don't imprison us, That's the great fight. And so we think this, the road to the future goes through enhancing democracy. There's no other path, which is why, going not to circle back endlessly to the Sanders campaign, but the fact that his democratic socialism, that's what it is. It's about expanding democracy, that any problem that comes along can be solved equitably, fairly, and compassionately. And that's our argument in the book. And we did it, again, independent of his campaign, but it dovetails it pretty much perfectly.
And I wonder if you could circle that around once again to why bother to support something like KKFI. I mean, in the mainstream media, we keep seeing things like Sanders has got some nice ideas, but look at Obamacare. You think he's going to get single payer through? Not a chance. How's he going to pay for free college for students? He's going to raise taxes. You can't do that. You can't do that. It won't work. You can't do that. We keep hearing that over and over again from the corporate media. Why is the somewhat different message of Democracy Now!, alternative radio, tell somebody, Heartland Labor Forum, why is that relevant and worthy of support?
Well, it's absolutely essential. I mean, this conversation we're having would never take place on a corporate news media or NPR. They're simply going to be the last ones to get the word. They're the last ones to find out. If one only consumed corporate media and NPR, you would have no way of understanding how Bernie Sanders could be dominating, and he is so far dominating the Democratic race in the way that was, that you would think he was getting 2% of the vote. You would think he was Dennis Kucinich's, successor. They're clueless. They really are, and they're going to be the last ones to find out. You want to find out yesterday's interpretation of mainstream reality, that's where you go. If you want to find out what's happening on the ground, the stuff that the people at the top, don't care about until it gets in their face, this is where you go. This is where you find about issues like this, like the Flint water crisis and the way that the disappropriation of African Americans all across Michigan in the last 6 years and taking away their rights for self-government. This is the place you go. And people who have been listening to this station understand the future better, the present better, and are equipped to participate in it effectively. To me, this is the sort of station that anyone listening right now, you've got to contribute. I mean, it's not an option. It's like, well, maybe I will. Maybe you can't give a lot. Maybe you can't give $50 or $100 or $200. We get it. It's a hard economy. But if whatever you give counts and helps. I mean, it's $5, $10, $15. Give whatever you can. And if there's someone out there who has good fortune, like Pete Merrill, you can give $1,000 or $500. Do it, because you can be certain that for everyone like you who can write that large of a check, there's 100 people who wish they could, but they can't. So you really, we're all in this together. It's your way of helping out.
888-931-0901 is the number to call. 888-931-0901. And as I think you've already suggested, but there are examples to look at of how something like akin to supporting your community radio station, some kind of grassroots thing, has worked, that we don't look to those examples and emulate them enough. One is the largely bottom-up couple million people stopping, at least for a time, the end of ownership restrictions in corporate media. That it wasn't enough for them that we went from 12 dominant corporations controlling radio and TV and publishing and you name it down to 5. That wasn't good enough for them. They wanted less restrictions. People stopped it. There were hints of it, I think, with the Occupy movement that kind of fizzled out. But put the 1% and some of this thinking and terminology into the mainstream media, even if they had to go kicking and screaming, they couldn't ignore it. There are examples of how this can work, aren't there?
Absolutely. They're all around us. And, you know, I unfortunately kind of have to race off now. I've got another meeting I've got to do. I think, Tom, this is what I want to say to your listeners. Listeners in Kansas City, we got to give Tom Clammer an optimism injection. The guy's working his butt off here doing this great show. This is a wonderful station. Now what I want everyone out there listening to, get on their phone, call the number, make your pledge, give your effective karmic hug to Tom and everyone at the station for the work they're doing. The work they're doing is so important. That's why I come on to do this show. And we're not losing. That's the point. The numbers are on our side. The other side knows it. That's why they're trying to rig elections. They're rigged media. And they're rigged economy. When we get the truth out, when we talk to people, we win. That should give us enormous power. But one of the key elements of that is having stations like this, shows like this. We get that money in there. Let's get Tom smiling by the end of the day.
Okay. 888-931-0901. Bob, I really appreciate your time. Have a good meeting, and thank you so much for
my great pleasure. And everyone in Kansas City, I love you. Be sure to caucus when you can in Kansas, vote in Missouri, and I hope to talk to you soon, Tom.
Okay, thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
And once again, this is Tom Clammer. That was Robert McChesney. Keep an eye out for his book coming out very soon. I don't have an exact date. People get ready. And people get ready to dial the phone and then do it. Give us a call, 888-931-0901. It is important to support this station that gives you the vital public affairs information vitally needed by a democracy that is in all too short supply elsewhere, plus all the non-corporate music. That is incredibly important also, both from pure entertainment and diversion point of view, but it's part of democracy too. Music that isn't picked by some corporate programmer in Texas or New York or Philadelphia, but by music programmers with a passion. But give us a call, 888-931-0901. Getting harder and harder for me to find the time to do this show. I hope to keep it going, but it's not looking good right now. But still, think of your contribution. All the money that comes in during all the shows goes into the same pot. But think of your contribution in the terms that Bob McChesney just laid out, and also as a vote, recognizing that you think this type of programming is important and will continue to be a big part of what KKFI is all about. Donate securely online at kkfi.org or give us a call at 888-931-0901. And I'm going to go out in just a couple of minutes with more of that show I did with the director of a nonprofit called Progress Michigan 2.5 years ago. Think about if the major media had made a big story out of this racist, corporatist, gotta say it, fascist emergency manager business in the state of Michigan. Citizens voted the law down, and they, like Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Terminator, they brought it back in a way that citizens could no longer vote it down. And that is a very direct reason on what happened to the water supply in Flint. There's all kinds of privatization and similar schemes supporting this. It's not democracy. It nullifies voting rights and just shreds them and flushes them down the toilet. That's what you got in Flint, Michigan. This comes in different forms elsewhere with a media not doing its job. It could happen here. It could happen all over the country. It is happening. Support information that disinfects some of this filth in politics and government. Thank you, Mark. I'd like to thank Nathan Klein. Loves the show and hope it stays. We'll see how that goes, but I really appreciate that, Nathan. Thank you so much. And I think we're going to go now to play out the show with some of that Progress Michigan audio from a show I did in September 2013. Mike?
So 2.3 million people voted to overturn the law when it was placed on the ballot. 65%, I believe it was, of all African Americans in the state of Michigan at one point in the state were actually under the control of an emergency manager. So they're elected officials for a vast majority of minorities in the state had actually been removed from their democratically elected positions.
I've been following an organization called Progress Michigan on Twitter for a while now, and I contacted their executive director, Lonnie Scott, to talk about the Michigan Emergency Manager Law. Lonnie is a leading progressive communicator with extensive legislative advocacy, nonprofit, and public policy experience. Give a listen. I'm on the phone now with Lonnie Scott, Executive Director of Progress Michigan, progressmichigan.org. Lonnie Scott, welcome to Tell Somebody.
And I just want to break in here with a couple more thank yous. Rebecca in Kansas City, Missouri, thank you so much for calling in. And Jack Poteet in Shawnee, Kansas, thank you. Nice to hear from you again. And thanks to everybody who supported this show. We'll see you next week with a special live show with Richard Tripp. So do tune in. Homelessness Marathon coming up soon, too. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next week with homelessness advocate Richard Tripp.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you taking the time. First off, why don't you tell us a little bit about who or what Project Michigan is?
Yeah, Progress Michigan is a 501c4 organization that was created to provide a strong, credible voice to hold elected officials and the government accountable. And so we are a coalition of grassroots supporters and just a group of folks who are out there trying to be advocates for working class families all across the state of Michigan.
And as we were chatting a little bit offline, I told you that I thought some of what's happening in Michigan hasn't gotten nearly enough play in the media. It's gotten a little bit here and there, but, you know, it seems like over the last 2 years we've heard an awful lot, as well we should, about Scott Walker and what's going on in Wisconsin. And we've heard talk, if not real good information, about the Detroit bankruptcy, but what set the table for a lot of this? Tell us about this emergency manager law in Michigan. When did that happen, and how did that all shake out?
Yeah, well, the emergency manager law originally started back in 2011. It was signed into law as Public Act 4. And back then, that was in March of 2011 is when the law actually took effect. And in November is when the Detroit mayor, Dave Bing, came out and said that Detroit could basically run out of money by April of 2012 and have a large, large shortfall by June 30th of that year. And so at that point, what happened is the emergency manager law actually allows the state to come in and take over a city or a school district, any entity like that, if there is some sort of financial distress or if it's deemed that there's financial distress. And it allows the state to basically get rid of and push aside all of the elected leadership in that area and appoint a state-appointed emergency manager to oversee basically the entire operation of everything that's going on. It's a complete disaster for democracy by kicking out all of these democratically elected officials and basically stripping them of their power. And so back in 2011, it was actually Public Act 4 was actually passed with some expanded powers as well. And it basically allowed for the state to come in and really declare a financial emergency and take over without as much justification as had been under the old emergency manager law.
Wow. And let's take a little time on this, because I think this is just stunning. Who decides when a city gets an emergency manager? What are the triggers or the threshold that has to be met, and who can they appoint?
You know, that's a great question, and I think that's a lot of the questions that the citizens of Michigan asked as the process happened. So the state treasurer basically performs a financial review of the areas where there's been what they declare to be a financial instability or a financial emergency. And then the state treasurer, along with the governor, are the ones who declare that they're going to appoint an emergency manager. And they select that person and put them into power. So as far as who can be an emergency manager, there's no real limitations. There is a one-day training class, to my understanding, that someone has to go through to be deemed qualified to be an emergency manager, and that person is selected by the governor and appointed by the governor with no input from the local units of government or from those who will be basically living in the community where that person takes over.
And what is this emergency manager empowered to do? What are his limits?
The emergency manager takes over all control, so he or she assumes.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of the February 4, 2016 edition of Tell Somebody, a conversation with Bob McChesney, and the last pledge drive edition of Tell Somebody. I do plan on doing occasional shows when I can and keeping the Facebook and blog pages and podcast site active. So keep an eye on tellsomebody.us, tellsomebody.libsyn.com, and like the Facebook page, facebook.com/tellsomebodynow. Follow me on Twitter @tellsomebodynow, and send me an email, mail@tellsomebody.us. I hope to see you around.